Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And welcome, as always, to the best audience in the world, in our great field of psychology, psychiatry, social work, child development, the whole arena of human services for people suffering from emotional and life problems. The best audience in the world for people who want to learn about the psychology of evolution as well. And we're going to, or evolutionary psychology, and we're going to dip into that today. But I have a big announcement today. Really, a very, very, lean forward, folks, a big announcement. This is the 300th episode, is how they describe it, of the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour on PRN-FM. It's also an annual anniversary for PRN, but I don't have what anniversary it is right here. I've been going on PRN for nearly 7 years. September 27th, 2010 was my first show. Isn't that something? What a long relationship. How long to be on the air and to have this great opportunity to be talking to you. The only way I know it's the 300th episode is on podbean.com, Podbean, B-E-A-N, podbean.com. They have a counter, and the counter tells me that the last show was $2.99. So, and what a great day to have on one of my dearest, dearest friends, Jeannie Stoltzer. Jeannie, you're on for the 300th show.
I am so excited. Thank you.
Isn't that a kick? We can talk about that when we're old.
Yeah.
Jeannie, let me tell you a little bit about Jeannie. She's been on the show before. And don't forget, folks, that if you go to Breggin.com, and you look up Dr. Peter Breggin's radio show, Live in Archives, right up near the top of the page, one of the first things on the page is, you can look up Jeannie's previous shows. You can look up anybody's previous shows. And a lot of the top people in the field have been on my program. I think maybe one of these times I'll just make a list of them on the air for you to get a sense of it. We've just had people on our show and continue to from all over the world. I'm working with a young psychiatrist not young at all, not by ordinary standards. And she's been listening to the show from the very first hour and enjoying it and learning from it, which is just a tremendous thing for me. So Jeannie Stoltzer, her last name is spelled S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. Her interests include biocultural aspects of breastfeeding. This is one of those times, by the way, that it's really worth listening to somebody's interest, because I'm not sure I've ever just listed interests. You know, this isn't like roller skating or something. Her interests, the biocultural aspects of breastfeeding. I've learned important things from her about this. Attachment parenting. I learned from Jeannie about this again. You know, I'd been reading the great attachment theorist and clinician, John Bowlby, years and years ago. Back in college, I was reading him on my own. A lot of what was really good at Harvard, I read on my own, but it was a stimulating place to be. And I hadn't integrated it into my recent thinking until I met Jeannie. She invited me to speak at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, Nebraska, Kearney, I guess you'd call it, Jeannie, right? Kearney, Nebraska?
Yep, Kearney.
Kearney. And Jeannie got me really thinking more about that and talking about it more in my work, about Bowlby and attachment going all the way back. And I'd started looking at human evolution for my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and which I mentioned Jeannie's work. And it helped me in my connections to our evolution to be talking with Jeannie about these issues. She's interested in evolutionary mothering and stuff like that, that is just the stuff of life. But how's this for somebody's list of interests? A tenured professor at a major university. How many think of those list as their interests the mass labeling and drugging of children and adolescents? Wow. I happened to just check out Jeannie's credentials again for the fun of it, you know, to be able to read a little to you and entertain you a little. And I came upon her student ratings. Oh, my God. Every professor must – I'm surprised they let her teach because her student ratings are so high. My experience has been that professors with the top student ratings, other people are often jealous of them. But, Jeannie, yours must be at the very top of the school.
I just somehow get the best students every single semester, and we just click and we hit it off. And it's been that way now for 15 years, and I can't be – I must be the luckiest person alive. I mean, I really, truly get up every day and think, yes, I get to go to work to be with these students. I love it. I love it. I love it. And they know I love it.
Jeannie, this is great. Well, look, it's my 300th episode. Just take off and talk about whatever you want to get across to people right now. About mothering, breastfeeding, evolution, human development. It just fits in with so many things I've been thinking about lately, including human development and nutrition. By the way, have you gotten much into that, Jeannie? I'm working with somebody whom you've met. I introduced you to her, Pam Popper, and she is a student of the evolution of human eating and deeply believes in a vegetable-based diet. Have you gotten much into that yourself?
Yes, I've really delved into it, and it was sort of an outgrowth of my breastfeeding research. When I look at how our diets as humans have been altered just over the last 75 years, you know, not speaking of the last 45,000 years, it's absolutely incredible. The diets that we have right now in 2017 America would be absolutely unrecognizable to our ancestors.
They would have choked on it, you think?
Oh, my God, with all the pesticides and the herbicides and the fungicides and all the artificial this and the hydrogenated that. What are we doing? Artificial sweeteners here. It's nitrates. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Do you think, Jeannie, that that we are poisoning our bodies with food, not to mention psychiatric drugs, with food and suppressing our immune system and causing all kinds of immune and endocrinology,
yeah,
with our endocrinology. Do you think it's affecting the way we think and feel and our hearts and our lungs? And what's your assessment at this point, if you feel you have enough information?
I don't think there's a doubt in my mind that what you just said is accurate. Not a doubt in my mind. When you alter a species diet the way we've altered our diet in modern-day America, it stands to reason, from a scientific perspective, there can be nothing but negative outcomes, and we're seeing them all over. And it's not just our physical health. It's our mental health. And when you couple that with our resistance to natural sunlight, we're never outside. And when we are, when we have our children at the park, we slather them full of sunscreen. So we make damn sure they can't absorb vitamin D. It's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life, how we're living.
Do you think this is really a huge problem? I'm beginning to think it's just very, very huge. One of the things that the Pam Popper has been expanding my education. And do you remember a few years ago when I said to you, you asked me, I think, what people had influenced my work? And and I laughed and sort of with a little arrogant, cute smile said, and Peter Bregan for a long time.
And yes, I remember. I'll never
and then
forget.
And then later I wrote in a letter for you of recommendation for an award that that you were one of the people that I was actually really learning from in recent years and re-stimulating my thinking a lot. Do you remember when I said that? Wrote that. You do, of course.
Pam Popper...
With whom I'm going to advertise it right now, folks. I don't even know if it's up on the web yet. But put aside November 10th through the 12th of this year, because we're going to go to Ohio and we do a conference with Pam Popper and her her health wellness forum. Just look up Pam Popper, and I've invited Peter Gerza, this fabulous researcher out of Great Britain, the only other physician I know who confronts stuff head on. And Peter Gerza has also been widening my horizons. It's interesting how this burst of widening my horizons by examining the medical establishment before he examined the psychiatric establishment. And you can look up Peter Gerza. And on my website, the GOTZSCHE, on the radio shows, because I've had him on about five or six times. He's been widening my understanding of the medical aspects. And now he's just doing amazing new research on the psychiatric mafia drug companies. And now Pam Popper is teaching me about nutrition and medical care. And all this widening is leading to me co-sponsoring, you don't know this actually, Jeannie, co-sponsoring a conference. Jeannie's the main sponsor. And so I'm going to talk, and Peter Gerza is going to talk, and then she's going to have people talking about food and health and your health for the other presentations. It's a broadening coalition now between the nutritional folks embodied by Pam Popper and my work, and now Peter Gerza is coming in, and I've introduced her to Jeannie. So I'm kind of on a new expansion here, Jeannie. What do you think?
I think I can't miss this conference. I have to be involved. I have to be involved in this one,
yeah.
And hope all your listeners are too, because with these people together, this is going to be, you know, setting the world on fire time.
And I'm going to be putting hours and hours of my work up, thanks to her, in video, with me working with groups. Is going to become a course, an accredited college course online for how to, why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. And then out of that is also going to come stuff up on the web that people can purchase, consumers can purchase, about doing psychotherapy and other related things. So we're doing, there's just a lot opening up now. It's a great time to celebrate my 300th radio show. And I'm doing all the talking. So Jeannie, back to you. Why don't you pick up somewhere and just talk, because you're gonna entertain and educate. Now, let me give the mic back to you, and I'm gonna take a breath. I'm more hoarse than usual from just doing videos, 22 hours of videos.
That's amazing.
Go, Jeannie.
I wanted to say a little bit about processed meat. Did you see this when the World Health Organization released their findings? They have sort of a categorization of what causes cancer. They say causes cancer, may cause cancer, probably causes cancer, and may cause cancer. So those are their classification. Did you know they put processed meats like bacon and ham and bologna, all the stuff with nitrates in it? They put it in the category of causes cancer along.
Sounds like the hounds of the Baskervilles in the background.
That was Heinrich Bulger,
the
German
chef.
That's the
best dog bark I've ever heard on the radio.
I'm so sorry. He was laying right beside me, and that was it.
Really, okay. Really loud and clear. You know what he's saying? Don't believe him. Don't believe him. I want my processed meat. No?
Give me my pepperoni. But they put it in the same category as they put cigarettes. That's a fact. Look it up. So when Dr. Popper's talking about food being lethal to us, you know, the way our diets have altered, she's got scientific evidence to back up her assertions. Absolutely. Okay, yeah. that was my food stuff. But what I really want to talk about is how we've altered mothering, because that's my forte, and that's what I'm so interested in.
Then it's got to do with food a lot. So you know, yes. We're integrated today. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, I just wanted to say that for 99.99999% of our time on this planet, we have mothered in very, very particular, specific ways. We practice exclusive and long-term breastfeeding. We practice co-sleeping. We stayed in close physical proximity to our young throughout their formative years. We mothered the exact same way as lions and tigers and bears. We really weren't different. We were all mammals. Now, of course, the amphibians and the reptiles didn't mother anything like us mammals, but we practiced very specific mammalian behavior patterns, and those have been altered incredibly. And our United States, we're the ones, and we have to be honest about this, we're the ones that altered this. It took really the richest, most educated nation that has ever existed on this planet to declare that our babies really don't need their mothers, and they just don't need them for the majority of, you know, their formative years. Daycares will do. Uninvested strangers formula that is made by the pharmaceutical industry will be just fine for them. It's really odd when you stop and take off your cultural blinders and look at what we've done, because the fact of the matter is our babies' needs haven't altered at all from 50,000 years ago. The only thing that's altered is our cultural scripts and cultural mores. That's what's altered. Our babies still need their mothers. And I do understand that I'm being very politically explosive. Bowlby, who I love, and I'm so glad that you brought him up, Dr. Bragan, because we've lost sight of him. No, we didn't lose sight of him. We threw him to the curb because he doesn't fit our cultural, political correct scripts that we've invented in modern day America. So we said, Bowlby, you're wrong. Babies don't need a secure base. Little ones don't need their mothers. And it's, in my estimation, a huge, huge scientific error, because we're going to pay for it. We're going to pay for it. And here's the craziest thing to me as a scientist. We had Bowlby's work in the 40s and the 50s, way before we started all this giant experimentation we're doing on our children, i.e. the daycares with uninvested strangers, the formula feeding, the cribs. We knew what it would do, and we did it anyway.
Well, we are paying the price. I mean, so much of mental disturbance, anxiety, guilt, shame, and the various psychiatric conditions are rooted in the disturbance of the attachment, the love. Let's call it love, the love and nurturing involved in the mother-child relationship, and the fact that it should go on for years. One of the things that that I think has kind of summarized the problem is this concept that it takes a village, and you may have said this to me, it takes a village to raise a child, and the answer is no. It takes a village to support the mother who raises the child.
That's what I said. That's right.
Yeah. Thank you for that, among other things I've learned from you. So talk about the actual details of this, about how mothers lived and how they worked and gathering and what the relationship was with the infant and the importance of the milk rather than other food products to sustain the child. Talk some more about that.
Well, one of my pet peeves is when I hear something like this. You know what started all these problems was the era of the working mother. Excuse me? When you look back in bioevolutionary time, there's never been a time or a culture where mothers didn't work. They worked and they worked and they worked from sun up to sundown. They weren't leaving the home to get a paycheck, but don't kid yourself, they worked. The only difference was is when they became mothers, they were expected to continue working and now to mother at the same time, simultaneously. You didn't get to, you know, put a baby to the side and say, okay, I've got to go out in the field and work. You strapped the baby on you, and you went to work. And that's what you did.
Yeah.
And you nursed
that's
all day.
That's so true. In fact, women worked, have traditionally and continue to in non-industrial societies, work much harder and many longer hours than the men.
Absolutely. And here's, I've seen this over and over again in my city. We'll have immigrant populations come in, and they'll start a restaurant, for example, and, you know, we'll go in because we hear it's a really good restaurant, and there will be the mother with a baby tied on her, and the dad will be out front wanting to seat you with his other child who's 4 or 5, and then there's a 10-year-old around there, too. And, you know, Americans are looking at this going, wait a minute, how come these kids aren't with a babysitter? The kids aren't with a babysitter because this family believes, because of the place that they immigrated from, that working and parenting occurs simultaneously. We don't leave our kids. We got to work because we got to support ourselves. So we take our kids. And it's just the most incredible thing to see. And I know from an American's vantage point, it looks like they're so out there and so bizarre. I mean, they just don't know what they're doing. But they know exactly what they're doing. They're forming attachment as a secure base. They have to make money. They have to work, but their children can be incorporated into that world, as it's been for millions of years in hominid existence. So we've just taken it completely upside down, declaring that mothering and working cannot occur simultaneously. And we've done women a great injustice, in my estimation. We have told them that if you're going to be out in the workforce, you're going to be in a man's world and you're going to play in their arena, i.e., no breastfeeding, no nurturing, no mothering, go play on their field. And I challenged that, and I said, no. I've written this many times over the years. Why do I have to play on your field? Play on my field. Let me take my baby to work. Let me nurture and mother, because it's something that I need to do. So I've been bucking our culture for a long time.
I've never really heard this explained before, the concept that I've always known that, you know, just in my studies, that women worked harder than men in almost every known culture or every known culture. And now homemaking is very, very hard. Takes a lot of time and energy and so on. But I've never heard it just proposed this way, that we actually just begin to set it up so moms can take their kids to work. And, you know, nowadays, obviously, with computers, they can often stay home and work from home if
Absolutely.
Employers would accept that.
Absolutely.
So,
I was in Paris.
Now, have you written that about that in particular, Jeannie? What kind of response have you gotten?
I'm sort of a polarizing figure. Either I'm absolutely loved and adored, or I am called all kinds of names like anti-woman and anti-feminist, and I'm a woman. So I don't see myself as anti-woman, but what I really am in my core, if they're feminist, then I'm a childist. And I know
God
I do.
God bless you.
That's mm-hmm. what I am, and I'll always be that. I was in Paris about...
Would you like to...
Go ahead.
I just
wanted to say that I was in Paris about 3 years ago, and I walked in this very exclusive shop, and the most beautiful woman in a Chanel suit came out, and right behind her was a two-year-old toddler, and she was showing me some shoes and some bags, and I just got this amazing smile on my face because it's happening everywhere. It's not just happening in tribal communities that women are taking their children to work. This is a very exclusive part of Paris. And this woman had to make a living, so she had a shop. But her toddler was there with her. And I just thought it was, I thought it was the most amazing thing. And it just helped to cement my belief system about mothering and working can occur simultaneously. And we have to take it to the streets. We have to say we will mother and work simultaneously. Now, there, of course, there's some professions it just wouldn't be safe. But most professions we could incorporate it into ours. Like, I took my son to work when I was a professor. I mean, I took him when I was teaching classes at the university. And, of course, it looked weird, but I did it. And it was so weird that nobody knew what to do or to say to me. So they didn't say anything.
So nobody in the dean's office said you can't bring your child to your son. You can't bring your son to to class.
No, they never did. And I looked into it, and we still to this day do not have a written policy. Maybe I shouldn't talk about this on the air, but here's my bottom line with that. We don't have a written policy, and the day we do that says you cannot bring your child to class, whether you're a student or a professor, I'm gone. And here's why. I cannot teach attachment parenting. I cannot and tell you you can't bring your baby here. I just simply can't do it.
So have you encouraged moms and dads to bring their kids to your classes?
Absolutely, 100%. And my dean's probably going to have a heart attack when he hears this on the air. But here's what I always tell them, and I do it before the child comes. If the child is in any way intrusive, making noise, you got to take them out in the hall and, you know, settle them. Because all it's going to take is one student to say, I couldn't hear anything in Stolzer's class because of this child. And then they might start thinking about a policy. So child I've had in class, my favorite ones are the nurslings, because they just wear a little, a wrap. Nobody can see anything, but they know that baby's nursing, and he's as quiet as a little lamb, just being there with his mommy. He's happy, all of his needs are met, and her hands are free because he's wrapped on her, and she's taking notes, and sometimes she goes to the back of the room and sways around with him because he likes that. But, yeah, I've done this for years, and I probably am getting myself in really bad trouble for saying this on air, but it's true. It is true.
Well, deans don't tend to listen to this show, so you're probably safe.
Well, but I might put mine on our university list and
say... Oh, there you go. You'll make the trouble for yourself.
There you go. Yes.
In fact, I know how loved you are. I've been there, and I know how loved you are by the people above you in the school organizational board. And that's wonderful. It's a great situation that you have. Wow. So talk some more about why it's so important for the infant, why in evolution and maybe today it's been so important for the infant to be getting milk from the mom.
It's not just what you would think it is. It's not just physiological needs. Of course, it's the top nutrients, the top minerals, the top antibodies. There's nothing that can even come close to it. But it also is meant to secure attachment. If you think about it, nature or God or whatever you call it that started all of this made it so that mammary glands, i.e. breasts, couldn't be taken off the mother's body. So when the mother lion is nursing or the mother human is nursing, there has to be skin-to-skin contact. There has to be eye contact, and that cements the attachment process when that's done over and over and over again. So many people think of breastfeeding just as nutritional, and it's clearly not. It's social. It's psychological. It's emotional. All these needs are being met, too. So it's like this umbrella that meets all of these needs. But what I really want to talk about that most people really don't know is this sort of psychological, physiological interdependence between mom and child when she's nursing. The longer she nurses, the more protected she is. We didn't know this for years and years. We were just looking at what effects it had on the child throughout their lifespan. But when we're looking now at mother and her physiological functionality, boy, we're seeing things. Things like rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, osteoporosis, cancers, particularly of the breast, uterus. Let's see. There's one more.
Ovaries?
Yes, ovarian, that's right. Ovarian cancer, the list just goes on and on. And then, of course, with the psychiatric disorders, it is significantly related to a reduction in bipolar disorder, any of the mood disorders, anxiety, depression. We don't see postpartum depression in communities that nurse for 2 and 3 years because they're secreting a nanopeptide hormone called oxytocin and prolactin. Again, those are called oxytocin and prolactin. Look those hormones up. They're called the love hormones in the medical literature. And when mom is nursing, she's secreting high levels of these, and they're called the love hormones because they induce feelings of things like serenity and bliss and being very, very calm and just this absolute incredible love for your baby and this need to stay in close physical proximity to him. And it's what God, or nature, whatever you want to call it, intended. We're supposed to be riveted on our young. And hormonally, it alters us when we nurse. So it not only takes care of us, of course, you know, the research is out since Gruley's work in the 1920s about what it does for our babies. And every single ailment, whether it's viral, bacterial, that you can mention to me, breastfeeding decreases. The only thing we do not have concrete correlates between is cervical cancer and breastfeeding right now. We cannot say that if you were breastfed long-term, your risk of cervical cancer are lower. We can't say that. But for almost every other thing we can, meningitis, staph, strep, diabetes, Crohn's disease, MS, heart disease, stroke, and this lasts throughout the life course. It's an amazing...
And you got good scientific research on this of people examining nursing parents, nursing moms, and comparing them to other kinds of moms?
Absolutely. And this, I've probably published more in this area than any other area. Look at our Surgeon General's blueprint for action on breastfeeding. The Surgeon General refers to breastfeeding as the most important component of maternal and child health. That's impressive.
Very, very impressive, Jeannie. That is so interesting. Well, I'm learning more than usual from you today. I hope people listening understand the profoundness and importance of the things you're talking about today. I know for us guys, you know, talking about nursing and stuff like that, and for many women who didn't nurse or didn't nurse very long, this is not fun to hear, but view it for what it is, a really positive outlook on humanity and on nature and nurture and how we need to change it, if not for yourself, for your children or for the people you know and work with or the people you treat in one capacity or another. This is such incredible... the important stuff. This whole idea, Jeannie, that we've got to look to those first couple of millions of years from when we climbed out of trees and take a look at what we really are, who we really are. And just to remind people, you know, modern civilization begins to barely show up 10,000 years ago. That's why Jeannie was talking about 99.99999%, you know. And even 10,000 years ago, that's just the first indications we have of it. It does it many, many places. It was even longer before we developed villages. And by beginnings of civilization, I mean villages, farming, and the use of animals, staying in one place because you kept animals and farmed and built more substantial shelters. This is such a recent thing for us. It only began again 10,000 years ago, and it didn't begin everywhere until later on. And in many people, indigenous peoples, these evolutionary ways of living continue to this very day. That's true, isn't it, Jeannie, basically?
Absolutely, 100%. We have them right now that look very much like we did 30, 40,000 years ago. They're living the exact same way. And it's an impressive thing to look at. I got to say this, Dr. Bragan, I have to before I forget. My work has nothing whatsoever to do with making women feel guilty, because moms and dads do the very best they can do with the information they have at the time. This is not about feeling guilty. I have to tell you a story about my Aunt Mary. She talks about her first baby, Johnny, being born in 1955, and she's laying there with her brand-new, beautiful son. The doctor came in and gave her a shot in her arm, and my Aunt Mary looked up at him and said, "Ow, what was that?" He said, "Don't worry, honey, I was just drying up your milk." That's...
Oh, dear God.
It has nothing to do...
That's assault and battery of the worst kind.
It is.
Man should be in jail.
The doctrine of informed consent is not being followed when it comes... Our doctors are still handing out free formula as we speak in offices and hospitals all around this country. That is illegal everywhere else on earth. We can't do that because formula isn't akin to breast milk, and we need to give women informed consent. So again, this has nothing to do with making women feel guilty. My Aunt Mary did the very best she could. My mother, with her seven kids, did the best she could. My mother was told her milk. I asked my mom, "Was I nursed?" "No, honey, I had a poison milk." Yeah, a doctor in Schuyler, Nebraska, a little teeny tiny town, told my mother that her milk was poisoned, so seven of her kids got no human milk. So no, this isn't about women and feeling guilty. They followed doctors' advice. This is bigger than that.
Well, in fact, women have been made to feel guilty about nursing their children and staying home, which is where most of them had to stay. They didn't have these opportunities to work and nurse. And they were made to feel guilty and even anxious about it, like it wasn't a good thing to do.
Absolutely. We've so sexualized.
So I'm so glad you've emphasized this. It's so important you've emphasized this.
But along with that, I do want to say this. Please look this up with the Surgeon General. This is not my research. This is the Surgeon General of the United States of America. According to the Surgeon General's report, if we nursed for just 6 months, exclusively, just 6 months, we would save $3.5 billion, that's a B, billion dollars a year on health care costs alone. If we breastfed for 1 year, exclusively, 1 year, no formula, no juice, just breastfeeding, for 1 year we would save $7 billion a year in health care costs.
And have so much healthier mothers and children.
That's right. It's staggering. And that is why places like Sweden and Finland and Italy and Austria and Israel all offer paid maternal leave, because they're not nicer than we are. They are money hungry just like we are, and they know how much money they save if these children are breastfed, and we know how much healthier their mothers are too, and they don't want to spend all that money on health care. They don't.
Let's hope it's Trump's daughter who's pushing for this. Is that right, Jeannie?
I haven't seen
pushing for maternal. She's been pushing for maternal leave paid for by the government.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm not a big government fan, but I think this is something in modern society that's absolutely necessary.
You want to hear the four countries that do not offer paid maternal leave for their mothers? They are Lesotho.
Oh,
Lesotho, Swaziland, Papua New Guinea, and the United States of America.
I'm learning too much.
Most of your listeners are going, "Where the hell is Lesotho?" It's an African nation that nobody's ever heard of. Same with Swaziland. But we're in there with Lesotho and Swaziland. We are.
One of the things I think is so interesting about human evolution is the fact that human beings are so relatively hairless. Now, one explanation that's given, I think, is that enables us to run longer distances and so on. Other anthropologists have very strongly suggested that it's our need to nurture one another and our infants that has given us this extraordinarily sensitive skin. And on a lighter note, I think it's closely related to why my little Shetland sheepdog, Sherry, rolls over on her back any chance she can get her tummy rubbed, because that's the only place where she doesn't have a lot of hair.
I believe you're right. Fur. Yes, they all do it.
Yeah. So, well, folks, the one reason why we don't have fur is because we need to be touching each other and loving each other and caring for each other. And in particular, we need to be nurturing. And I think it would be hard to nurture with a bottle, with the same skin touching and the same feeling about it. Because the infant responds to feelings, the most subtle feelings. I think I'm right about that, aren't I? And
absolutely.
Being on the breast is just not the same as being on the bottle.
It's not, and it wouldn't be for a baby lion or a baby bobcat or a baby rat. It just isn't. Can it keep them alive? Yes, it can. But I was thinking about your hairless hypothesis. Ooh, then think about dolphins. They must really, because they don't have any. Well, they do, but it's very downy soft. So they must really, and they are. I mean, we know they are. They're very, very familially oriented. And
I don't know if they touch a lot. They certainly touch some. I actually got the chance to pet a dolphin once, and it was quite rubbery, but maybe that would still be very sensitive to each other.
Well, I know they nurse for 4 to 5 years.
Wow. Do they really?
Yes, I know. That's a fact. Yep, they nurse for 4 to 5 years. Their lifespan is between 60 and 70 years, and they nurse for 4 to 5 years.
I bet whales do, too, a lot of the whales.
Whales longer. Whales nurse longer. I think it's – I better be careful. I think it's 7 to 8. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then here we come in the United States at 6 weeks. And it's not funny because – that's when we send women back to work. We say to them, you know, time to do something important now. Go. We really do. We have constructed this society where a woman's worth is based on her economic earning power. If she's a professor or a nuclear scientist or an orthodontist, we like her. And she goes up the social strata. She does. And we are impressed with her. But if she raises her children, we ask, what's wrong with her? What happened? But I have to say something. There's another code word that I almost just broke, and that is when we talk about stay-at-home moms. Throughout evolutionary time, mothers never stayed at home. Do you think a mother was in her cave 50,000 years ago sitting by herself with her 2-year-old? She wasn't. She was with all kinds of women, nursing her children, talking to the women on a loom, doing this and making this and gathering this. And she was with women, talking and nurturing her children. She was never isolated in a home by herself. I hate that term, stay-at-home mom. I hope to God, if you're raising your kids, you're everywhere. You're at the library and at the swimming pool, and you're in the forest. And you're at the university. I hope you're not staying home.
Oh, that's such good imagery. It's such good imagery. And, of course, the women were taking on very difficult tasks of going out into the bush, into the woods, into the fields, the trees, going into very dangerous situations, taking their children. They had to stick together a lot. They had to fend for each other.
That's it.
I mean, it's such a different picture.
They were fending for each other. You just hit it. They knew they were dependent on one another for optimal health. And people, that's when it talks, when I talked about the village. No, the village isn't raising the child. The village is making the mother able to raise the child. You're helping her and protecting her while she does this. And that's why men are so important. I know some people, because I've actually got this before, but I know some people think that I am negating men, and I am not. Men are critically important. They are the ones that make it possible for her to nurture. Without that protector, they can't do it. It's hard to do it. He makes it all possible. And the newest research that's coming out right now that I'm really loving is that men that are supportive of their women nursing long-term have women that nurse long-term. And that's important. That's really important for men to understand. If you're supportive of this and you're protective of her, she's more likely to nurse your child long-term.
Yeah, that's, I'm not a great favorer of genetics when it comes to things like psychiatry. There's really is no genetics of mental illness of any kind at all. But there is a genetics of human life for sure.
Yeah.
And here we can look at the at evolution and how it it always goes through genes, obviously, and the manifestation genetically of what good health is. And we can look at when how that gets disrupted, not to cause a so-called mental illness, but to cause failures in life, emotionally and physically and emotionally, failures in life, which people can recover from, but which often, because of those first 3 years, aren't what they should be. So the person continues to suffer from that. A good part of psychotherapy is nurturing.
Yeah. But we're losing that.
We're losing it.
Because we give you a pill and send you on your way. The true psychiatrist used to be the nurturer, the finder of blocked feelings and emotions, and they sat and they talked with you and they empathized with you, and all of that's missing. We need to feel like we're safe.
Well, that was also a very tiny part of psychiatry that lasted about 20 years under the influence of psychoanalysts, including Bowlby. But the history of psychiatry, there ain't much nurturing. There's a lot of locking up and torturing. But we've got a fresh start with modern psychotherapy. And I urge psychotherapists, while establishing very strong ethical barriers between you and your patient in any kind of informal outside the office or in any romantic way, you know, therapists should not be afraid of being nurturing. It may be the most important part of all there is to psychotherapy. When I was younger, I asked all my patients who were doing well, why they were doing well. And I hoped and expected them to say, well, you know, your brilliant insights, the hard work we did on childhood and those kinds of things. And it was like almost like they'd talked to each other, which they hadn't. They all said, you cared about me so much, I started to care about myself.
Yes.
And only today am I putting the word nurturing on that. That's got to be nurturing.
I am so glad you just said that, because really, truly, at our root as humans, don't we want to be loved? Don't we want to be affirmed? Don't we want to be cared about? Don't we want to feel safe? That's really what we're all about, and it really doesn't matter what station we hold in life. That's a need, to feel those things.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that people who acquire considerable power do is gather huge support networks around them, whether they're athletes or presidents. One of the first things they do is develop a group for themselves to support them and encourage them and root for them. And in the case of maybe athletes, maybe, you know, they also gather people around them to help train them and keep them learning and growing. And we just forget all that.
We do forget all that. And now people are on all the social media stuff, and they're not even talking to each other. They're not even looking at each other. They're on this machine typing in, you know, four or five word phrases to, they don't even talk to each other. They don't look at each other. It was supposed to be a great communication tool. It's isolating us. We're lonely.
And we don't even know why. We don't get it. We don't sense who we are as mammals with marvelous imaginations, mammals with high intelligence. We're still mammals, and it isn't, you know, we like to say, that love is our highest achievement, but it's also the achievement of other mammals as well. Not the way we can conceive of in the Golden Rule and other, you know, great moral imperatives that we've learned, but mammals too. That's one of the reasons we love our dogs. They keep reminding us about affection.
Yeah, and don't forget they love us.
Yeah.
They love us.
Yeah.
They love us, and they love us unconditionally. We don't ever have the fear that our dog is going to betray us. But a family member might, and he might today. I really, truly
Go ahead.
I really, truly believe that's why we've been with dogs, and maybe you'll disagree with this, but I think it's about 40,000 years. I know there are some scientists that dispute that, but I believe that. I believe it's about 40 to 45,000 years because they fulfill a need in us that we can't get with humans, that unconditional love, that fidelity, that never betraying you. And that's what we all need. We all long for it, and we want it from our mothers and our fathers, and many of us didn't get it.
I agree with you a lot about the dogs. I've been studying dogs a lot and the evolution of dogs. In fact, I've written a novel about it, which I haven't been able to publish. So if you got a publisher out there or maybe a co-author who writes fiction, I got a finished novel on how we grew with dogs, starting, in my opinion, just like you, about 40,000 years ago. But to satisfy the scientific view, I made it a little nearer to present time. It takes place as the glaciers recede about 20,000, 25,000 years ago. And as the glaciers are still coming down. I really do think that dogs are key to the burst of culture, at least part of it. I don't want to overdo it. Key to part of the great cultural burst that takes place starting about 40,000 years ago in human beings.
I agree 100%. 100%.
We have art artifacts going back to then. We got cave drawings starting not long after. We've got evidence of religion, spirituality, burying our dead, and so on. All from that period of time, and there's at least one or two places where we're burying our dogs with their favorite things. So, I think this is real.
I think it is, too. What do you think about elephants burying their dead?
Tell me about that.
Well, there's evidence that they do, and they do it in family. I don't want to use this word because I'm humanizing elephants, but I don't have another word. They do it in family plots. And their range is something like 600 or 800 miles, their range is. And when they come around the burial grounds, they drop to their knees, and they trumpet. I am not going to say what that means, because I can't. But we do know that that occurs.
So now, you didn't mean burying underground. You meant burying in plots of bones and
Yes, I mean they're
things.
Buried.
So, yeah.
They're buried.
Yeah. I've heard a lot about and seen photographs of elephants seem to love and appreciate the bones of their nearest of kin. We've got about 3 minutes left. First, I want to just say again, this was my 300th episode, according to the counter on podbean.com, which has all 300. You can also get to it from my radio, from my website, Bregan.com. And this is also the 12th anniversary of PRN, I've been on the air with them for nearly 7 years. And what a wonderful thing to have my dear friend, Jeannie Stolzer. I've been so excited talking about her that I haven't mentioned her name enough. Jeannie Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. You can go online and learn all kinds of things about her. And I will be having Jeannie on the show on a regular basis as I'm moving more and more toward having some of the best folks in the world be on the air more often. And that's actually very much in keeping with radio and television today, where there are frequent guests. And Jeannie, you're going to be one of my frequent guests. Bless you for coming on today. Any parting thoughts? Probably about 2 minutes to go now.
Well, my parting thoughts as you were talking, as I've told you this before, so I'll tell it to you on air, that you have been my mentor from afar. I really can't think of very many papers I've published that you are not cited over and over again. I can't thank you enough for what you do. I can't thank you enough for the changes you've made and that you continue to make. I know the world is a better place because you're here. And thank you. That's what I wanted to say.
Well, thank you much. And it's interesting to me, you know, again, thinking about the influences in my life. You've been a very big influence in my life. Pam Popper has been a big influence in my life. Ginger is the biggest influence in my life. Her mother is a very big influence in my life. I had a wonderful talk today, last night on the phone with her. We ended up talking 45 minutes as I debriefed my filming and visit with Pam Popper and all the things we're doing. And they're women. They're all women. That's,
wow.
That's really interesting.
There
are some good men out there doing great work. Bob Whitaker, Peter Gerza, and others. But they're doing things I understand, where I've most deeply learned in my adulthood, where I've most deeply learned from, has been from women, and some of it in very recent years. It's so interesting. I never thought about it, Jeannie. Well, any other thoughts before we go? I want to thank my audience for listening to this show, because I think it's a very special moment in time to hear Jeannie and perhaps myself too talking about this coming together of mental health, evolution, nutrition on a scientific basis. And it's a direction that I'm going to be going in more. And maybe you wait around long enough, folks, and you're going to see me and some of my friends creating some medical clinics based on this kind of combined understanding, where medicine is the last resort for medical issues and no resort for psychiatric issues, and nutrition and therapy are the first resorts. Wow.
Won't that
I'm
be
really doing that, Jeannie. I'm moving in that direction.
And it'll be so magnificent. I just got chills when you said that. It'll be so magnificent.
Well, this is what Pam Popper and I are talking about, among many, many other things. So she really is oriented to delivering services. Folks, so you can start the music at the studio to end, because Jeannie and I are both having chills and we're ready to wrap it up. So thanks for listening to this show. And folks, send this show around. Let it go around. Bye-bye, Jeannie.